4. And yet, as readers, we are never at all certain how to read his play. Every reader seems to confront a different play each time she rereads. Claudius, Hamlet's mighty opposite, is anything but that. He is a master of shuffling, no more. When he prays ineffectually, he says of heaven, "There is no shuffling there." But this does not deter him from prodding Laertes with a little shuffling, to exchange rapiers with Hamlet, so as to give the prince a poisoned wound. Hamlet yearns to shuffle off this mortal coil. The word play upon shuffling is Shakespeare's hint at how utterly incommensurate Hamlet and Claudius are. The other characters also offer no true foils to Hamlet. Laertes, empty-headed, conventional, manipulable, could be any avenger, while Fortinbras is one more military head-basher, ironically given the last word, shoot, as he appropriates the dead Hamlet for a military funeral. Ophelia's role has pathos, but she is only a victim, pushed back and forth between her father and her not very loving lover. Polonius is a fool, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are minor league opportunists, and the admirable Horatio lacks all personality, being Hamlet's straight man. Queen Gertrude is a sexual magnet, but little more. Only the gravedigger clown is able to offer Hamlet some companionship in wit. The play is endlessly different, because Hamlet is so extraordinarily mutable, and there is no other possible centre of interest upon the stage with him, except, quite briefly, the equivocal ghost of the warrior-lover on father, King Hamlet. Shakespeare, ironical beyond our comprehension, has given us a play that is all Hamlet, subtle, volatile, supremely intelligent. If you read well and deeply, then you have no choice. You will become Hamlet, sometimes to your bewilderment. What matters most about Hamlet is not his predicament, but his endowment. He will expand your mind and spirit, because there is no other way of apprehending him. But nothing is got for nothing, and he will also draw you into the abyss of his consciousness, which has in it elements of nihilism surpassing Iago's, or Edmund's in King Lear, or Leontes in The Winter's Tale. Shakespeare is, by definition, more comprehensive and varied than Hamlet can be, but if we can personify the nihilist poet in Shakespeare by any single figure, it must be Hamlet, since Iago writes with other characters and their lives, while Hamlet writes fresh passages for the players and improvises uncanny little songs. Yet Hamlet is a nihilist poet in a double sense, subject and stance. In a play that talks about plays, in language that discourses upon itself, Hamlet believes in nothing, including language and the self. Christian critics ought to be uneasier with Hamlet than generally they are. Hamlet is still ahead of much of his audience in post-Christianity. Not that we can credit even Hamlet with mere skepticism. How, in this play, can we know when he is an actor and when he is the prince? Hamlet has, at moments, the unsettling detachment that Shakespeare himself manifests in the sonnets. Both speak only what is already dead in their hearts, though only Hamlet expresses a kind of contempt for the act of speaking. And yet he sincerely professes an admiration for good playing, for actors who will speak precisely what Shakespeare wrote. And he is himself the best of actors. He requires an audience, and captures his audience forever. But is he more an actor, or more a poet? Shakespeare, we gather, was what we now call a character actor, particularly good at playing older men and English kings. Heroes, villains, and clowns were not roles for him. It startles me, though it shouldn't, to think of him on stage as the ghost addressing his son Hamlet. Poor Shakespeare was in armour, and even stage armour is heavy stuff. We don't want to see Hamlet in armour, and we don't. The prince is theatrical enough without it, and as an ironist or nihilist poet, he would deride it. We would wince at hearing Hamlet cry out, "Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more," or "Close the wall up with our Danish dead." Prince Hal, particularly in Henry IV, Part I, has a touch of Prince Hamlet, but after he becomes Henry V, he is more like Fortinbras, though an unlikely Fortinbras who has been educated by Sir John Falstaff, the Socrates of Eastcheap. Shakespeare brilliantly but sadly, this being after all tragedy, does make Hamlet more actor than poet, or rather the reader, though dazzled by Hamlet's poetry, is necessarily even more engaged in trying to work out when Hamlet is acting and when he is not. When reading Hamlet, one must always keep an eye upon both the actor and the poet in him. And so I turn to the soliloquy of soliloquies. We are in Act 3, Scene 1, approaching the close of that long gap Shakespeare cuts into whatever dramatic illusion a drama centering upon Hamlet could possess. Ahead of us are Hamlet's instructions to the players, and his production of The Mousetrap. There can be no central passage in Hamlet. The play is too various for that, and its protagonist too volatile. Yet for more than two centuries the to-be-or-not-to-be speech has been so popular that it now appears staled with repetition. I greatly admire the romantic critic Charles Lamb, who was my precursor in exalting the reading of Shakespeare over attending wretched stage performances, but I don't want readers to yield to Lamb's despair as to the possibility of freshly confronting this gorgeous soliloquy. I confess myself utterly unable to appreciate that celebrated speech, or to tell whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. It has been so handled and pawed about by declamatory boys and men, and torn so inhumanly from its living place and principle of continuity in the play, till it has become to me a perfect dead member. The soliloquy, third of seven in the play, explores the negative relation between knowledge and action, and so is the seedbed of the great poem that Hamlet will write for the player-king, with its climactic lines, "But orderly to end where I begun, our wills and fates do so contrary run, that our devices still are overthrown. Our thoughts are ours, their ends none of our own." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 192 to 195. The great soliloquy opens so familiarly to the reader now that it is of some importance to listen very minutely to what Hamlet is saying, to himself and so to us. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them. Even here Hamlet is ironic, if you pay attention to the metaphor of fighting with the sea, which all your soldierly prowess cannot hope to end. The sea will end your troubles, and you, as Hamlet implies. The reader should be wary of assuming that the question of being or not being altogether refers to suicide. Hamlet does not truly contemplate self-slaughter. His high irony, like Shakespeare's in the sonnets, always intimates a measure of detachment that is a little beyond us. Hamlet primarily is brooding upon the will, as Shakespeare so frequently does in the sonnets. Does one have a will to act, or does one only sicken unto action, And what are the limits of the will? How can a consciousness, even so vast as Hamlet's, ever be aware enough of all relevant contingencies to will any end, when it cannot know what the ends of its own thought will turn out to be? Hamlet's malaise, as Nietzsche recognized, is not that he thinks too much, but that he thinks much too well. He will perish of the truth unless he turns to art, but he is royal as well as noble, and a nostalgia for action haunts him, though his intellect is profoundly skeptical of action. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment with this regard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 83-88. Let us read these lines closely. The metaphor of the sea of troubles still reverberates in their currents, which assimilates the enterprise of revenge to the baffled reality of troubles, and ironizes the great pitch and moment, so that we hear the sea's motion mimicked in the language. Hamlet, like Shakespeare's disciples Milton and the Romantics, wishes to assert the power of mind over a universe of death or sea of troubles, but cannot do so because he thinks too lucidly. The prince prophesies our limits 4 centuries later, when any of us comes to realize that even enormous knowledge of our own consciousness is of little help in knowing what is not conscious, the mystery that baffles the will. 5. Before the slaughter that ends the play, Hamlet says to Horatio, "I shall win at the odds, but thou wouldst not think how ill all's here about my heart." That is foreboding, yet relates also to the fear of leaving behind one a wounded name. Hamlet, at the close, desires our good opinion, and little else. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. His spirit is ready, willing, and his flesh is not weak. He dies extraordinarily to the music of his own Let It Be. No death in secular literature haunts the reader more. Why? Hamlet's final words, "The rest is silence," are spiritually ambiguous, yet I read them as anticipating annihilation rather than resurrection. Therein may be the best answer to the question, why read Hamlet? He does not die as a vicarious atonement for us, but rather with the single anxiety of bearing a wounded name. Whether we ourselves expect annihilation or resurrection, we are likely to end caring about our name. Hamlet, the most charismatic and intelligent of all fictive characters, prefigures our hopes for courage at our common end. Henrik Ibsen, Hedda Gabler. "There must be troll in what I write," Ibsen. "I must disclaim the honor of having consciously worked for women's rights. I am not even quite sure what women's rights really are," Ibsen. "If Ibsen was a feminist, then I am a bishop," James Joyce. Hedda Gabler, 1890, is a great tragicomedy, and the masterpiece of the aesthetic age. I place it here between Hamlet, 1600, and The Importance of Being Earnest, 1895, partly because it occupies a middle position between the ironic tragedy of Hamlet and the sublimely nonsensical comedy of Lady Bracknell and Wilde's other zanies. But since Hedda Gabler is subtly and profoundly a Shakespearean play, I choose it also to show something of the extent to which even Ibsen, a superb original, had to be post-Shakespearean in all of his modes. How to read Hedda Gabler is also a training in how to read most post-Ibsenite drama. Oscar Wilde, after attending Hedda Gabler, wrote, "I felt pity and terror, as though the play had been Greek." Wilde, in 1891, did not add that the pity and terror were also for himself, as he was too astute not to recognize in Hedda's self-destructiveness something of his own doom-eagerness. But Wilde was no Iago. He did not destroy others. Hedda Gabler is a marvelous blend of Iago and Shakespeare's Cleopatra, at once a genius revising the lives of others and a heroically fatal woman. Partly because of Ibsen's overwhelming influence upon Arthur Miller, too many readers and playgoers think of the poet of Brand and Peer Gynt as being a purely social dramatist. Ibsen had some social concerns, but they were peripheral in comparison to his demonic obsessions with character and personality, to what I would have to call his trollishness. A borderline troll, like his own Peer Gynt, Ibsen essentially portrayed himself in the great troll, or more precisely, Huldre, Hedda Gabler. In Norwegian mythology, a Huldre is a daughter of Lilith, Adam's first wife, who abandoned him, according to the Kabbalah, after a dispute over the proper position for sexual intercourse. Trolls incarnate fiercer versions of our erotic and also our destructive drives, and though they are demons or fairy folk, they can masquerade as human. Norwegian folklore is replete with stories of men who marry Huldras, the most deceptive and enticing of female trolls. Cold beauties, their trollish nature takes the external form of a cow's tail, which drops off outside the church where they marry their human husbands. Hedda, the daughter of the late General Gabler, is of course not literally a Huldre, but that is certainly a part of her symbolic identity in the play. Just as Cleopatra is Antony's serpent of old Nile, so there is something serpentine about Hedda. But Cleopatra is one of Shakespeare's most magnificent creatures, and the superb Hedda shares Cleopatra's wit and allure, as well as Iago's manipulative splendor. What Hedda does not share with Cleopatra is either the Egyptian queen's social audacity or her joyous sexuality. Like Ibsen himself, who was unfulfilled by his marriage, Hedda desires sexual love, yet dreads it. And again, like Ibsen, Hedda has a horror of losing her societal respectability. That horror is related to the fear of being exposed as a Huldre, or in Ibsen's case, revealing his lustful trollishness to his public. Hedda, 29 years old, has married down, is pregnant with an unwanted child, and is hideously bored by her husband, George Tessman, a fairly typical, good-natured, but foolish academic researcher. But even a more fascinating husband, like her former admirer, the Dionysiac poet Eilert Löwborg, a satire upon Strindberg, would not rescue Hedda from her malaise, nor would a military career like her father's, General Gabler's, save her from herself. Not that this is available to her in the Norway of 1890. It would be pointless to lament that Hedda is trapped in a woman's body, or in an absurd marriage, or that she cannot head up the Norwegian armaments industry. Her first entrance establishes the state of her soul, The maid has left the French windows open, and the room is flooded with sun. This light's blinding me. William Hazlitt remarked of Iago that he plots the ruin of his friends as an exercise for his understanding, and stabs men in the dark to prevent ennui. Ibsen took the hint from Iago, except that Hedda plots the ruin of Lovborg by burning his manuscript, and then coolly gives him one of her father's dueling pistols, urging him to do it beautifully. He is to shoot himself in high style, thus gratifying Hedda's authentic aestheticism, in which Iago again is her forerunner. In notes towards the composition of the play, Ibsen remarked that Hedda represents ennui, and added, "Life for Hedda is a farce which isn't worth seeing through to the end." She hastens that end by writing her own farce, with Lovborg as initial victim, but herself as the final self-destroyer. Yet, if she is a female Iago with much of his brilliance, she is also a Cleopatra, with more than we might expect of Cleopatra's fatal attractiveness, though she does not share an infinite variety. If her inner self is Ibsen's, we can understand the dramatist's palpable relish in her annihilation of the drunken poet Lovborg, a sly portrait of the playwright Strindberg, who hated Ibsen with fierce envy, and whose hatred Ibsen joyously returned. As of yet, we are only on the outside of this extraordinary play, and it is time to read our way deep within Ibsen's savage masterwork. Though she has flirted fiercely with Lovborg before her marriage, he was for Hedda an experience in vicarious sensation, since she served as confidant for his Dionysian exploits. Her actual desire, as is intimated throughout the play, was a repressedly lesbian sadism towards her younger schoolmate, the beautiful Thea Elvsted. It is perfectly plain that, at the least, Hedda wishes to pull out Thea's splendid head of hair, then make a bonfire of it. This is an ambition that goes back to their schoolgirl days. Hedda's pyromania again stems from Iago's. Both would burn all humankind away. There are only 7 characters in Hedda Gabler, and 2 are inconsequential, Tessman's aunt and Hedda's maid. Besides Hedda and her husband, Tessman, and Lovborg and his inspirer, Thea, there is also the play's villain, Judge Brack, who lusts after Hedda and who will prompt her suicide at the close. It is vital that the reader recognize that Hedda is a heroine villain, as it were, Cleopatra as well as Iago. We never lose dramatic sympathy with Hedda, or with Cleopatra, or Iago, even as we fight her Huldra fascination, which is incessant. Hedda's greatest fear, besides public scandal, is that she will be bored to death. Yet she herself is so sublimely perverse that she could never bore anyone else. But Judge Brack is merely manipulative. We quickly loathe him, and we understand why Hedda chooses suicide when she falls into his power. He discovers that Hedda has instigated Lovborg's accidental suicide with the gift of one of her father's pistols, and he gives her the choice either of public exposure or of becoming his mistress, each totally unacceptable to her. Brack is a powermonger. Even his desire for Hedda seems more an assertion of the will than of the loins. What does Hedda Gabler want? Cleopatra wished to rule over all the world, in company with her Antony, while Iago longed to disintegrate Othello, and brilliantly achieved this ruin. Restless, vibrant, yet life-denying, equivocal in every respect, Hedda desires a Huldra's revenge upon human reality. Even her barely repressed passion for Thea is frighteningly destructive. Any sexual embrace of Thea would be followed by an attempt to burn Thea alive. Since Thea has rescued Lyveborg from dissipation and inspired him to write a supposedly great manuscript on the future of civilization, it becomes necessary for Hedda to burn the only copy of what would have been Thea's book by Lyveborg, that is to say, their child. Hedda. She throws one of the pages into the stove and whispers to herself, "I'm burning your child, Thea. You with your beautiful wavy hair." She throws a few more pages into the stove. "The child Eilert Lyveborg gave you." Throws the rest of the manuscript in. "I'm burning it. I'm burning your child." Translated by Michael Meyer. This remarkable deed and utterance closes the third of the four acts. The reader is to remember that Hedda herself is pregnant. There is some question whether the manuscript is not only a surrogate for Thea's hair, but also for Hedda's own child, who will never be born. Splendidly lurid as is the scene, its hysterical malevolence contains a strong element of what Henry James, attending its London performance in 1891, called an ironical pleasantry. Ibsen's ironic humor crests in Hedda's dismay that Lyveborg has not committed a Dionysian self-immolation with beautiful style, but rather has died accidentally in a high-toned bordello. Hedda. "So they found him there?" Brack. "Yes, there, with a discharged pistol in his breast pocket. The shot had wounded him mortally." Hedda. "Yes, in the breast." Brack. "No, in the stomach. The lower part." Hedda looks at him with an expression of repulsion. "That, too? Oh, why does everything I touch become mean and ludicrous? It's like a curse." Translated by Michael Meyer. With a great actress such as Peggy Ashcroft or Maggie Smith playing Hedda, this was both horrible and delicious. No one truly loves anyone in this play. They are all solipsists. Hedda the most sublime of all. Thea and Tessman get happily to work, assembling the notes from which they may reconstruct Lyveborg's masterpiece on the future of civilization, which, of course, is as likely to be ludicrous as was poor Lyveborg's end, since he evidently, in a bordello scuffle, shot himself in his private parts. One sees why Strindberg was so enraged, though the trollish Ibsen must have been laughing with a terrible laughter. Flaubert confessed, "I am Madame Bovary." No confession from Ibsen was necessary. More than the scamp Peer Gynt, Hedda is Ibsen, and even he may have flinched a little at the end he composed for her. Hedda, from the rear room, "I can hear what you are saying, Tessman, but how shall I spend the evenings out here?" Tessman, looking through the papers. "Oh, I'm sure Judge Brack'll be kind enough to come over and keep you company." Brack, in the armchair, calling gaily, "I'll be delighted, Mrs. Tessman. I'll be here every evening. We'll have great fun together, you and I." Hedda, loud and clear, "Yes, that'll suit you, won't it, Judge? The only cock on the dunghill." A shot is heard from the rear room. Translated by Michael Meyer. We can be certain that Hedda Gabler has done it beautifully, if hardly as elegantly as Cleopatra in her apotheosis of a suicide. Not exactly a feminist martyr, and restricted to a narrower stage than Cleopatra's World Theatre, Hedda has nevertheless done the best she could manage in the stifling middle-class morality of Ibsen's Norway. If she does not dazzle us quite as Iago does, we must grant her that Lyveborg is no Othello. With scabrous irony, Ibsen has surrounded the Huldre Hedda exclusively with second-raters, who scarcely provide her with provocations to anything like the full potential of her beautiful wickedness. Yet I wonder sometimes if I am as fond of any character in the drama of the last 100-odd years as I am of Hedda. There is Lady Bracknell in Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, but she comes out of the world of nonsense. Lewis Carroll, W.S. Gilbert, Edward Lear. Chekhov's heroines are lovable, and I enjoy them greatly, but from a distance. The disturbed and disturbing Hedda Gabler is up close. Ibsen kept a scorpion under glass on his writing desk, and delighted in feeding it chunks of melon. Hedda Gabler, deadly and fascinating, is the child of that sensibility. Oscar Wilde, The Importance of Being Earnest. 1. After Shakespeare, most of the best stage comedies in English were written by Anglo-Irishmen. William Congreve's The Way of the World, Oliver Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer, Richard Brinsley Sheridan's The School for Scandal, were joined in later times by Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, John Millington Synge's The Playboy of the Western World, and Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Wilde's delightful play, Earnest, as I shall call it for short, may also be the best British comedy since Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, surpassing the rival works that I have listed. Earnest is a miracle of a play, perpetually fresh and thus refreshing, and it is Wilde's masterpiece, wonderful as two of his critical essays are, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, and the dialogue The Decay of Lying. The true affinities of Earnest are with Lewis Carroll and with Gilbert and Sullivan. Wilde did not compose light comedy in An Ideal Husband, Lady Windermere's Fan, and A Woman of No Importance. These still stage very well, but could not in genre be compared to Patience, Iolanthe, and Through the Looking Glass, and even to the nonsense books of Edward Lear. Earnest is part of the cosmos of nonsense literature. One could add the short stories of Saki, H.H. Munro, and the novels of Ronald Furbank. Nonsense literature, at its finest, frees us of ordinary nonsense by taking us into a realm at once weirdly light and ultimately unsettling. The masterpieces of nonsense in English are Carroll's Alice books, but Earnest is worthy of dwelling close by. In the original four-act version of Earnest, greatly improved by condensation into three, Wilde's surrogate Algernon states Wilde's law. My experience of life is that whenever one tells a lie, one is corroborated on every side. When one tells the truth, one is left in a very lonely and painful position, and no one believes a word one says. In The Decay of Lying, Wilde's spokesman Vivian casts aside the weak lies of politicians. They never rise beyond the level of misrepresentation, and actually condescend to prove, to discuss, to argue. How different from the temper of the true liar, with his frank, fearless statements, his superb irresponsibility, his healthy, natural disdain of proof of any kind. After all, what is a fine lie? Simply that which is its own evidence. If a man is sufficiently unimaginative to produce evidence in support of a lie, he might just as well speak the truth at once. For Wilde, to originate or to set in motion is to lie. When Alice, in Through the Looking Glass, gives her name in answer to Humpty Dumpty's gruff demand, he interrupts her to ask, "What does it mean?" "Must a name mean something?" Alice asks doubtfully, and Humpty Dumpty replies, "Of course it must. My name means the shape I am." The importance of being Ernest, the name that both Gwendolen and Cecily desire for a husband, as Wilde knows but does not tell us, is that Ernest, E-A-R-N-E-S-T, or Ernest, E-R-N-E-S-T, goes back to the Indo-European root Ur, which means to originate. To be Ernest is to be original, a nonsense formulation that Wilde slyly enjoys because originality usually is alien to his own genius. No character in Ernest is at all original. Each is sublimely outrageous, but always in a traditional mode, and yet the play is marked by a vivacious originality. The grand personage in Ernest is Lady Bracknell, perhaps the most outrageous comic character since Sir John Falstaff, the star turn in Shakespeare's Henry IV plays, and Shakespeare's only creation who competes with Hamlet in popularity, from Shakespeare's days until our own. Here is Lady Bracknell, imperiously concluding her interview with Jack, after he has proposed to Gwendolen. On being informed by Jack that he had lost both his parents, Lady Bracknell had observed, "To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness." There, as in the interview's conclusion, one hears the style of Dr. Samuel Johnson, which melds with Falstaff's mockeries of pomposity to produce Lady Bracknell's rolling periods. Lady Bracknell. "In what locality did this Mr. James, or Thomas Cardew, come across this ordinary handbag?" Jack. "In the cloakroom at Victoria Station. It was given to him in mistake for his own." "The cloakroom at Victoria Station?" "Yes, the Brighton line." "The line is immaterial, Mr. Worthing. I confess I feel somewhat bewildered by what you have just told me. To be born, or at any rate bred, in a handbag, whether it had handles or not, seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life that reminds one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution. And I presume you know what that unfortunate movement led to. As for the particular locality in which the handbag was found, a cloakroom at a railway station might serve to conceal a social indiscretion. Has probably, indeed, been used for that purpose before now, but it could hardly be regarded as an assured basis for a recognized position in good society." "May I ask you, then, what you would advise me to do? I need hardly say I would do anything in the world to ensure Gwendolen's happiness."
"I would strongly advise you, Mr. Worthing, to try and acquire some relations as soon as possible, and to make a definite effort to produce, at any rate, one parent of either sex, before the season is quite over."
"Well, I don't see how I could possibly manage to do that. I can produce the handbag at any moment. It is in my dressing room at home. I really think that should satisfy you, Lady Bracknell."
"Me, sir? What has it to do with me? You can hardly imagine that I and Lord Bracknell would dream of allowing our only daughter, a girl brought up with the utmost care, to marry into a cloakroom and form an alliance with a parcel. Good morning, Mr. Worthing." Lady Bracknell sweeps out in majestic indignation.
Lady Bracknell's gratuitous asides are Wildean triumphs, poised upon the verge of nonsense, The line is immaterial, whether it had handles or not, of either sex. A girl brought up with the utmost care, an alliance with a parcel. How are we to read Lady Bracknell's grand pronouncements? That, I take it, is much the same question as, why does Lady Bracknell delight us so much? In part, Lady Bracknell is so funny because she is so humorless, in stark juxtaposition to Falstaff. But since Wilde is composing a farce on the border of nonsense, Lady Bracknell is in no way a representation of an actual person. Shakespearean comedy is not Wilde's prime model. In 1881, Wilde had been satirized as Bunthorne, the aesthetic sham of Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience. After that, Gilbert hovered in Wilde's creative mind, though without real effect until Ernest, which owes rather more to Iolanthe and the Pirates of Penzance than to Patience. Algernon, Jack, Gwendolen, Cecily, Miss Prism, and Canon Chasuble are none of them as fantastic and imposing as Lady Bracknell, but they are no more attached to the reality principle than she is. Wilde's aesthete dandies and his grotesques always return us to Wilde himself, a master of language, fantasy, and of the paradoxes of art. W.S. Gilbert was rather less than that, but Wilde, like Shakespeare, cheerfully appropriated from everyone, and Ernest subsumes Gilbert and Sullivan, but in the interest of an aesthetic vision alien to them. In a subtle sense, Ernest is more akin to Falstaff's ethos and to Sancho Panza's than to anything else in literature. Wilde's A Trivial Comedy for Serious People, its misleading subtitle, takes us into the realm of childlike playing, a world where the presence or absence of cucumber sandwiches is as momentous a crisis as any other could be. Indeed, when I think of Ernest, I remember first Lady Bracknell, and next the cucumber sandwiches, an item of cuisine that now permanently suggests the sublime Oscar. Part of how to read Ernest is to munch the occasional cucumber sandwich as one proceeds, accompanied either by tea or champagne, both in the play's spirit. Having devoured all the cucumber sandwiches, while denying them to Jack, Algernon then engages his servant Lane in a wonderful exchange. Lady Bracknell. And now I'll have a cup of tea and one of those nice cucumber sandwiches you promised me. Algernon. Certainly, Aunt Augusta. Goes over to tea table. Lady Bracknell. Won't you come and sit here, Gwendolen? Gwendolen. Thanks, Mama. I'm quite comfortable where I am. Algernon, picking up empty plate in horror. Good heavens, Lane, why are there no cucumber sandwiches? I ordered them specially. Lane, gravely. There were no cucumbers in the market this morning, sir. I went down twice. Algernon. No cucumbers? Lane. No, sir. Not even for ready money. Algernon. That will do, Lane. Thank you. Lane. Thank you, sir. Goes out. Algernon. I am greatly distressed, Aunt Augusta, about there being no cucumbers, not even for ready money. Algernon's incessant interest in eating is an obsession of this young dandy, and goes on throughout the play. It must seem odd to compare Algernon to Falstaff, who has only a negative relationship to the world of elegance, but Wilde, who loved Falstaff, seems to have divided Falstaff between Lady Bracknell, language, and Algernon, appetite. Everything matters in art except the subject, Wilde remarked, another of those aphorisms particularly valuable in our ideological era. 2. Wilde might have titled his best play The Importance of Being Insouciant, except that, as we have seen, the secret meaning of earnest for Wilde was to originate. To be original was to lie, but to lie insouciantly in the interest of art. The play's philosophy, Oscar told a friend, was that we should treat all trivial things very seriously, and all the serious things in life with sincere and studied triviality. One thinks again of Algernon's interest in food. "I hate people who are not serious about meals. It is so shallow of them." Are we to read Ernest as farce, as nonsense, or as Wilde's great morality play? As all three, I would urge the reader, since Wilde manifests his beautiful genius so definitively here, and perhaps here alone. Everyone in the play is admirably selfish, that being a prime virtue in its absurd realm. Wilde's characters, as Gwendolen proudly remarks, never change, except in their affections, and they are always serious liars. Presiding over them is Lady Bracknell, who, like a high romantic poet, imposes her vision upon reality, though her vision is a parody of mere selfishness. There is neither sin nor guilt in the understructure of Ernest, where the paradox of serious lying is that everyone in the play tells the truth, whether as an afterthought or through outrageousness and hyperbole. That is because aesthetic lying is visionary and opposes not truth nor reality, but time and time's vassal nature. Lady Bracknell is a grand figure because she is a triumph over time, the goddess of sincere and studied triviality. Jorge Luis Borges observed that Oscar was always right, or almost always. As a playwright, Wilde is a superb critic, always original in his quotations, as Arthur Symons remarked, and he is also a civilized autobiographer, since that, for Oscar, was the essence of criticism. Wilde warns the critic against falling into careless habits of accuracy, since the higher criticism ought to see the object as in itself it really is not. This means that Ernest rejects both nature and society and disdains imitating them. The passionate celibacy to which Lady Bracknell momentarily condemns Gwendolen and Jack, Cecily and Algernon, is a wise joke, and not the refined perversion we might be tempted to envision, since Wilde's characters are not human beings. They are paradoxes at play in the field of Wilde's most joyous vision. Like Wilde's satire, always gentle in earnest, the drama's essential gaudiness is kept under careful control. I spoke of Lady Bracknell's triumph over time. In truth, the play ends as Lady Bracknell's triumph. Her selfish virtues dominate the wonderful conclusion, where everyone is on the verge of marriage, all with her firm blessing. Should we not read the drama with the realization that Lady Bracknell, and not Jack or Algernon, is Wilde's true surrogate? If Ibsen was Hedda Gabler, then Oscar was Lady Bracknell, since her outrageousness transcends that of everyone else in the play. Lady Bracknell pulls out her watch. "Come, dear." Gwendolen rises. "We have already missed 5, if not 6, trains. To miss any more might expose us to comment on the platform." I once wanted to use this as the epigraph to my book, The Western Canon. It has no epigraph, but was voted down by my editors. It seems to me a touchstone for the reader in the year 2000, and for all truly canonical imaginative literature. How to read The Importance of Being Earnest? We should begin by recognizing what Lady Bracknell sublimely cannot, No one on the platform, seeing Gwendolen and her formidable mother, could possibly know that they have missed any trains, let alone 5 or 6. So egomaniacal is Lady Bracknell that all the world is not only her audience, but indeed her schedule-keeper. Yet that is her zany greatness and the plays, and that is why we need to go on reading The Importance of Being Earnest. Summary Observations. Shakespeare, whose art is so rich, is also the master of ellipsis, the art of leaving things out. In Antony and Cleopatra, we do not see the imperial lovers alone together. We have to imagine how they are to one another when their onstage audience of followers and retainers are not present. King Lear is a play in which the prime villain Edmund and Lear never speak to one another. Shakespeare wants us to surmise why it would be unfeasible for them to communicate. In Hamlet, as I've indicated, there is an extraordinary difference between the prince in Acts 1 through 4, where he is perhaps 17 or 18, and the mature figure of Act 5, who is at least 30, though the lapsed time depicted in the play seems no more than 3 or 4 months. Reading Shakespeare's plays, you learn to meditate upon what is left out. That is one of the many advantages that a reader has over a theatre-goer in regard to Shakespeare. Ideally, one should read a Shakespearean play, watch a good performance of it, and then read it again. Shakespeare himself, directing his play at the Globe, must have experienced discomfort at how much a performance had to neglect, though we have no evidence of this. However instructed by Shakespeare, it is difficult to imagine the actor Richard Burbage catching and conveying all of Hamlet's ironies, or the clown Will Kemp encompassing the full range of Falstaff's wit in the Henry IV plays. Even the most aware of readers probably cannot absorb all the theatricality in Hamlet and his play, which is a poem unlimited, never to be exhausted. That is the glory of Hamlet, and helps account for its centrality in literary experience. Ibsen, subtly and covertly influenced by Shakespeare, blends Cleopatra and Iago, as we have seen, in the madly attractive Hedda Gabler, an authentically fatal woman. Theatricality in Hedda is not as infinite as in Hamlet, but still is strongly present. Both Shakespeare and Ibsen enhance theatricality, the play's consciousness that it is a play, partly to suggest a context of nihilism that in Dostoevsky is represented by the yellow atmosphere of Petersburg. Since in drama we learn what we must learn in soliloquy or in dialogue, the informing voice of the novelist is substituted for by theatricality itself. Shakespeare's immense influence upon most of the novels considered in this book testifies to how extraordinarily successful Hamlet was and is in expanding the horizons of literary art. I have argued that Ibsen be read as we read Shakespeare, and not as we read or attend Arthur Miller. Oscar Wilde's great comedy clearly requires a different kind of reading, one more appropriate to the literature of nonsense, the art of Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, and Gilbert and Sullivan. Nonsense is a variant of literary fantasy, and addresses itself to the adult implicit in the child, and the child hidden in the adult. Though Lady Bracknell has Falstaffian elements, as I have remarked, she would be more illuminated if she had to contend with Humpty Dumpty. The Importance of Being Earnest is best read in close conjunction with the Alice books. Sometimes it is good to fantasize Shakespeare surviving into later times, partly so that he could sample literature centuries after his own triumph. If there is an afterlife, and people go on reading in it, surely more appropriate than their watching celestial television. I would want to hear Shakespeare reading aloud from Through the Looking Glass. Chapter 5 Novels, Part 2 Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Herman Melville's Moby Dick is the indisputable ancestor of the six modern American novels I shall consider in this chapter in two sequences. The first is constituted by William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts, Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49, and Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. The second comprises just two novels, Ralph Waldo Ellison's Invisible Man and Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. But since the binding force ultimately for both sequences is Moby Dick, I want to begin by glancing briefly at that most negative of all American visions, at least before McCarthy's Blood Meridian. How to read Moby Dick is a vast enterprise, as befits one of the few authentic contenders for our national epic. But since Captain Ahab is the protagonist of the novel, I will confine myself to glancing at some of the problems in reading that Ahab presents. Clearly a Shakespearean figure with affinities both to King Lear and Macbeth, Ahab is, like Macbeth, technically a hero-villain. After more than 60 years of rereading Moby Dick, I have not swerved from my reading experience as a 9-year-old. Ahab, to me, is primarily a hero, as the persona Walt Whitman and Huckleberry Finn are rival American heroes. Yes, Ahab is responsible for the death of his entire crew, himself included, with the single exception of the Jobian survivor, the narrator, who asks us to call him Ishmael. Yet Ahab has rallied his entire crew to him, even his reluctant first mate, Starbuck, when he appeals to them to join his revenge quest to hunt down and kill the evidently unkillable Moby Dick, the snow-white Leviathan sperm whale. Whatever his culpability, their choice was free, though only refusal as a group could have deterred Ahab. It seems best to think of the Pequod's captain as a tragic protagonist, closely akin to Macbeth and to Milton's Satan. In his visionary obsessiveness, Ahab has a touch of the quixotic in him, though his harshness has nothing in common with the Don's spirit of play. William Faulkner remarked that Moby Dick was the book he wished he had written. His closest version of it was Absalom, Absalom, where the obsessed protagonist Thomas Sutpen may be considered Faulkner's Ahab. In his highest rhetoric, Faulkner observed that Ahab's end was a sort of Golgotha of the heart become immutable in the sonority of its plunging ruin. Ruin there is hardly dispraise, since Faulkner added, "There's a death for a man now." Moby Dick is the fictional paradigm for American sublimity, for an achievement on the heights or in the depths, profound either way. Despite Melville's considerable debts to Shakespeare, Moby Dick is an extraordinarily original work, at once our national Book of Jonah and Book of Job. Both biblical texts are cited explicitly by Melville. Father Maple preaches his marvelous sermon using Jonah as text, while Ishmael's epilogue takes as epigraph the formula used by all four messengers who report to Job the destruction of his family and worldly goods. "And I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Radical originality marks Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, which I judge to be his masterpiece, surpassing even Light in August, Sanctuary, The Sound and the Fury, and Absalom, Absalom. The same originality attends Nathaniel West's short novel, Miss Lonely Hearts, and Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49. A frightening originality is the mark of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which seems to me, as we enter the 21st century, the strongest imaginative work by any living American writer. True originality, always difficult to achieve after Shakespeare and Cervantes, is particularly hard for American literature of the 19th and 20th centuries. Concerning the 21st, I make no prophecies, but since the United States is already the evening land of Western high culture, a sense of belatedness will be hard to evade. Starbuck tells Ahab that the hunt for Moby Dick is against God's purpose. But just who is Melville's God, or the God of those who came?